Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us today to pick apart the political landscape as of late, Hans Hassel, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College. Hello, Hans.
Hello.
Welcome to the program. Also, Jim. Jim has stepped into our studio in Jim McCormick. And yes, Jim does have a last name. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. The excitement of this fund drive is overwhelming. Is overwhelming, especially when you're speeding toward a successful finish. Jim and Hans, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Let's clip through these things. Wow. We think we have a big week. Last week, the week before, and then we get a week like this. Would you agree, Jim, this is a big week in terms of political developments?
Oh, absolutely. And, they have this theme on television, on these cable stations, about breaking news. And we've had breaking news virtually every few hours here over the past week.
Yep. Well, let's talk about the breaking news from this morning. In a news conference this morning, Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan announced he would fill out his term, but he would not seek re-election.
It's almost hard to believe, but I have been a member of Congress for almost two decades. This is my 20th year in Congress. My kids weren't even born when I was first elected. Our oldest was 13 years old when I became Speaker. Now all three of our kids are teenagers. And one thing I've learned about teenagers is their idea of an ideal weekend is not necessarily to spend all of their time with their parents. What I realize is, if I am here for one more term, my kids will only have ever known me as a weekend dad. I just can't let that happen.
That was Paul Ryan, part of his announcement this morning that he will fill out his term but not seek re-election. Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, not in the future of that body. Hans Hassel, how much of a surprise is this?
Well, the surprise about the fighting your kids—that's not very surprising, right? That's,
the teenager news—we know that, yeah.
That's a very typical excuse for getting out. I mean, I don't really buy the motivation. I think that most people in elective office, especially federal elective office, have political ambitions, and this is not a change of heart, but the desire to spend more time with your family.
I really think that this is
essentially, Paul Ryan recognizing some of the writing that's on the wall, recognizing that there's going to be continued inter-party fights and recognizing the high likelihood of a change in power in Congress and perhaps not really wanting to be in the minority. And also have to deal with challenges to leadership.
Hans, how much do you think this had to do with the way Paul Ryan juxtaposed himself with the president and the president's turmoil in his now over first year in office?
I think that has not helped. But I think that what's really driving this is a strategic retirement. This is a recognition that it's an uphill battle going forward. Most projections now have essentially it's a coin flip as to whether or not the Democrats take over the House. And I think that's weighing on his mind. I think he recognizes it's going to be a much tighter race. His district is not a safe and secure district for the GOP. It's a marginally more Republican district, and it gets even more competitive, I think, without Paul Ryan there as an incumbent.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, Jim, with this news 7 months before midterms in 2018?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a stunner of an announcement. Really, was I think totally unexpected. Yeah, the district that he comes from is a bit competitive, but he's been very well in southeastern Wisconsin there, and so I obviously don't think he would have any problem getting reelected. I suspect there is a little bit. He has this penchant for going home every weekend to Janesville, where he's from. And that's got to drain a little bit, aside from the you know, the business of wanting to spend time with his family. And I do think the relationship with Trump and, you know, the kind of the frustration of sort of the unpredictability of some of Trump's stances on various issues. And Ryan in this very delicate position of having to defend the administration and trying to get Trump's, you know, agenda passed in the House, you know, probably he decided that after 20 years, maybe he can do something else for the short term. But I don't think his political ambitions are over. I think, as Hans said, you know, these people in Washington, you know, they live for sort of the kind of the next next opportunity, sort of the political structure of opportunity that they might have. So I think he'll go back to Wisconsin. Can't run for governor right now with Walker running for re-election and the Senate. You know, there is a Senate race, but, you know, he wouldn't jump into that. But, you know, maybe down the line he would run for the Senate with Senator Johnson if he decides to leave the Congress.
Mm-hmm. We have a leadership battle now shaping up in the House just 7 months before the midterms. Put it that in the context, Hans, how does this potentially color the election season we have before us?
Well, I mean, I think that we've got to get to the midterm elections first. I don't think you're going to really see a clear battle until after. You know, you might start some positioning and some additional fundraising by some people aiming to move into leadership. But it's really, I don't think you're going to get it. You're going to see a clear battle develop until after the midterm elections. One of the things that I think is particularly striking about this, though, is once you eliminate this electoral connection, it gives Paul Ryan a lot more liberty to act in certain ways. We know that some political science research has shown extensively that when you cut that tie to the electoral connection, individuals act differently. And I think this will be really interesting to watch how Paul Ryan changes and acts, you know, after he's announced essentially that he's not going to run for re-election. He no longer has to, you know, be accountable to Republican primary voters, and who probably are, you know, very pro-Trump, and it may be very interesting to see, right, where does his clear ideology come out when now that he's no longer, you know, as hard tied to the party, right? He may still have, you know, progressive ambitions for other offices in the future, but he no longer is responsive to the voters of his particular district in that same way.
Mm-hmm. Hans, I think you've looked back at other speakers of the House in recent history. How does this one fit in? How does Paul Ryan fit in terms of the way he's performed as a speaker? I know that position has also changed, become more challenging.
Yeah, so I think that he has much lower profile, in part because he is right. He's serving in a time of unified government, and when you're in time of unified government, you don't focus so much on the Speaker of the House. I have not looked recently at kind of national approval ratings of the speaker, but I think that he is. I mean, I think it's part of this is a kind of a recognition that particular job has become more difficult as you've seen splits within the Republican Party. I think it's a very difficult for a Republican speaker right now, just because you'd have that you know, difficult division within the party with the Freedom Caucus and kind of more Main Street Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Will this, Jim, do you think, trigger more GOP retirements? We're seeing a record number of House members who say, you know, this is a good exit point.
Well, I think the number is like 39 or 40 Republicans have already announced, you know, their retirement. So I would expect a few others. There's still, I think there's something like 19 states that still have deadlines of, you know, filing. So we may see a few more retirements. I'm not sure that it would spark, you know, a wholesale exit, but it might. From some of those that are wavering, I think they might take the opportunity to do that, especially given that, you know, the filing deadline is still available.
I see likely future House Majority Leaders names mentioned: Kevin McCarthy, Hans of California, also Steve Scalise of Louisiana, the House Majority Whip. Are those the names on your list as well?
I think that's right. One of the things, going back to what Jim's point is, I think that one thing to notice, right, we think of 2006 as a particularly bad Republican year. The upshot, New York Times has done some analysis and showed that there are more Republican retirements in potentially competitive districts now than there ever were in 2006 or 2008, right? So to give you a sense as to what the sense among Republican elected officials is, right, I think that's a very clear indication of how bad they think this really could be.
Mm-hmm. Do we have disappointment, some would say, in the performance, a swing away from the Republican Party? Are the Democrats there, Jim, do you think, to take advantage of this window of opportunity? Do they have the leaders? Do they have the issues to drive this home?
Well, they have the money for one thing. One of the things they've been able to do is raise lots of money and also recruit lots of candidates and diverse candidates. And I think that will probably, help the Democrats in the short term. On the issues, it's hard to clear, hard to know whether it's going to be an issue-driven kind of midterm election, or is it going to be just simply a referendum on the sort of the performance of the president in office writ large in terms of kind of the style of leadership. I don't think that you can point to, and maybe Hans wants to weigh in here, on a particular issue that the Democrats would be advantaged on at the moment. I think it's more this perception of overall leadership.
Mm-hmm. Hans?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you really do is you for Democrats, you're aiming to recruit really good quality candidates, and they've done that, right? There are these reports of high volumes of women who have announced candidacies, a lot of candidates with previous elected office experience, right, which is really this measure that we use in the political science discipline for understanding, right, what the likelihood of winning a competitive seat is. We know that candidates with previous electoral experience are much better, generally do much better than candidates without a political background. And we've seen that Democrats are doing a very good job at recruiting those candidates for this election cycle. In terms of issues, I mean, I think it's a general anti-Trump sentiment, I think, largely. And I think that you can, over the last couple of years, elections have become much more nationalized, and you can pick up on those issues. And I think that you'll see that general check on the president as a primary motivation for running and as an issue they try to highlight.
Okay, we want to move.
I think there's one other thing that if I could just throw in.
Yep.
Reapportionment still favors some of these Republicans, even that are retiring, and I think that's sort of the kind of the caution that the Democrats have to work through. Even with open seats and competitive elections, as Hans said, in terms of the candidates and all that. The reapportionment has really advantaged the Republicans over time.
Okay. We're going to take a short break after a minute. But first of all, let's preview a little bit of what we'll be talking about after the break. In response to the news of the apparent chemical weapons attacks by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad against his own people, President Trump said no option is off the table.
It was an atrocious attack. It was horrible. You don't see things like that, as bad as the news is around the world, you just don't see those images. We are studying that situation extremely closely. We are meeting with our military and everybody else, and we'll be making some major decisions over the next 24 to 48 hours. We are very concerned when a thing like that can happen. This is about humanity. We're talking about humanity. And it can't be allowed to happen.
Okay, President Trump talking about Syria. Talk about that situation in just a minute. Matter of fact, the news on that front this morning, President Trump answering a Russian threat to shoot down any U.S. missiles in Syria, tweeted out, "Get ready, Russia, because they will be coming nice and new and smart," adding, "You shouldn't be partners with a gas-killing animal who kills his people and enjoys it," coming hours after Russia's ambassador to Lebanon warned that his country will shoot down any U.S. missiles fired at Syria in a punitive strike on the Damascus regime over this alleged use of chemical weapons. We'd like to have you join our conversation. We'll get Jim's thoughts, Hans's thoughts when we come back as we tackle Syria. What are your concerns about U.S. military action in Syria? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can email us with your politics question, query, observation, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org, 1-866-780-9100. Back with Hans Hassel of Cornell College and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. In just a moment, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back to Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with Hans Hassel of Cornell College, where he's an assistant professor of politics. Jim McCormick, always great to have Jim on board in our Ames studio, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Of course, Jim with a great expertise in foreign policy, and that's where we want to turn to for the next few minutes. As I mentioned before the break, we have a back and forth, Jim, the president saying, get ready, Russia, in a tweet, because we will be coming nice and new missiles in Syria, U.S. missiles in Syria. And this is interesting, Jim, because isn't he doing exactly what he criticized President Obama for doing, forecasting, announcing military action before it happens?
Absolutely. Just telegraphing his next move. And there have been a couple real instances of this. One was just about a week ago when he said American forces were going to withdraw from Syria. Very soon was his direct quote there. And then now with these tweets about that there is going to be a response, he's really boxed himself in. He's got to do something in terms of credibility. Otherwise, you know, he further follows what happened with Obama in terms of setting a red line and then not following through. So I'm not sure how this is a very good diplomacy, you know, to box yourself in like this in terms of possible action.
Mm-hmm. Jim, what options are there if we say there is going to be that there is this boxed in sense that President Trump has said he will act given another killing with chemical weapons there, Assad of his own people. What are the possible retaliatory strikes, and how effective would there be? Last year we had a strike.
One idea, of course, is to follow the example of a year ago and just to hit sort of the air bases. I think the other is to hit command and control centers, which they've talked about for some time with regard to Syria. Of course, the real danger is if there are any Russians or if there's any Russian casualties, that further complicates the actions that are taken. The other option, because he said he also wanted to take those that are really allied with Syria with regard to Iran and Russia. Of course, I suppose he could impose more sanctions on Russia, and that certainly is what some one of the senators in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has talked about, maybe that he could impose even greater sanctions on Russia for their backing of Assad. But the problem is that the United States has, frankly, long ago decided that ISIS was really the problem in Syria, and they have backed away from trying to get rid of Assad. And you know, the Russians moved in and back in 2015 in September, and so I don't think that these actions are going to be more than symbolic outcomes in terms of trying to rein in Assad. But I'm not sure that they really have, to get really to your question, that they're really going to have an overall effect.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting also the president's reaction. I read the tweet to get ready, Russia, because they will be coming, answering the threat to shoot down any U.S. missiles in Syria. But saying, you know, get ready, they will be coming, U.S. missiles in Syria. But then also, I think less than an hour later, calling for a better relationship with Russia. Tweeting, our relationship with Russia is worse now than it has ever been, and that includes the Cold War. There is no reason for this, the president tweets. Russia needs us to help with their economy, something that would be very easy to do, and we need all nations to work together. Stop the arms race? End of the president's tweet. Do you see, in these tweets and also in what the president says, Jim McCormick, any strategic vision for where this leads U.S. foreign policy regarding Syria, the Middle East, and our relations with Russia?
Well, you know, Russia and Turkey and Iran have had some discussions, you know, about some kind of a settlement in Syria. Maybe he's trying to signal, and I have no information on this. Maybe Trump is trying to signal to the Russians that he wants the Russians to play some kind of a coalition government outcome or some kind of a, you know, accommodation between the opposition forces in Syria with the Assad government. I mean, that would be the only thing that I could sort of read into that, you know, those particular tea leaves. And maybe this kind of action that is taken. And you know, now also, I guess I should mention that the Trump administration has been obviously consulting with allies. And it'll be interesting to see if this is a combined action with the French or the British in terms of taking some action with regard to Syria.
Hans Hassel, your thoughts as on what seems to be an impending military strike in Syria?
Well, I think a lot of this is signaling to certain constituencies back home. Trump's tweeting in past times has not necessarily been to set foreign policy, but to communicate and to signal to certain groups within within the Republican Party and within the kind of his constituency that are attentive to what he's saying. And I think that explains kind of what he says more than a cue of foreign policy. I think it undoubtedly kind of often worries our allies and others, but I think that right, if you view it in that sense, I think it makes a lot more sense.
Mm-hmm. Hans Hassel with us of Cornell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Let's move on to the big news from earlier this week. On Monday, federal agents raided the office of Trump's longtime personal attorney, Michael Cohen, following a referral from the special counsel, Robert Mueller. The raid prompted a furious response from Donald Trump. He said that the raid represented, in his words, an attack on our country. Now, to be clear, the FBI agents who raided the office of Cohen were looking for records about payments to two women who claimed they had affairs with Donald Trump, as well as information related to the role of the publisher of the National Enquirer in silencing one of those women. It's important, is it not, Hans, to point out that this is not the Mueller's special counsel that did this. This was a search warrant carried out by the, as I see here, the Public Corruption Unit of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan.
Yeah, so I think that is important to point out. This is not necessarily directly connected to the investigation in Russia's meddling with the 2016 election, which Mueller is kind of authorized to investigate. This is something else entirely. I think this is in regards to the payments that Trump's lawyers made to these women in exchange for their silence, and looking as to whether those are legal, whether they violate campaign finance laws, whether they violate money laundering, things like that. And so that's the question, right? This is not directly related, but because it involves the president, I think it's often viewed as it may eventually land on Mueller's desk in some way.
Mm-hmm. Reports on yesterday's White House briefing focused on Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders not repeating earlier assertions that while President Trump believes he has the power to fire Robert Mueller, he has no plans to do so. Here's a bit of the exchange with the White House press corps on that matter.
Certainly believes he has the power to do so. John.
If I could, you have said several times from the podium that the president has neither the intention nor is thinking about firing Robert Mueller. Does that remain the case today?
The president was asked this question directly last night, and I'd refer you back to his comments.
Now, congressional leadership has repeated its assertions that legislation is not needed to prevent President Trump from firing Mueller. But our Senator Chuck Grassley, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, issued a warning to the president, this in an interview on Fox News.
I think it would be suicide for the president to fire him. I think the less the president says about this whole thing, the better off he will be. And I think that Mueller is a person of stature and respected, and I respect him. Just let the thing go forward.
Okay, just let the thing go forward. Jim McCormick, your thoughts here. The president, hinting about doing something about Mueller. Do you think that's still a possibility, a real threat?
I really don't. I think that even Trump, with as impetuous as he can be, realized that the political costs would be so catastrophic, and even among his Republican supporters in the Senate, that I don't think he would really fire Mueller here. Mm-hmm. I think the other likely target, there's been a lot of speculation, and I don't know, maybe you're going to get to this, but he was going to maybe change the deputy attorney general, Rod Rosenstein. I think that even that is certainly, I suppose, it's possible for the president to do that. But the political cost to me would not really instruct the president to follow that route.
Mm-hmm. Jim, you've been following, as we all have, the last year, but you with the political analysis hat on over the last year. How would you characterize what happened Monday, this raid of the president's longtime personal attorney, in the big picture of Russia probe developments? How significant is this?
I think it's significant in the sense that they apparently scooped up all kinds of memos and emails and the exchanges. And I think one of the things that struck me, is there any kind of private communication between the president and his attorney there that would indicate, despite the president's denial of information about these payments or informations about that he had had affairs with these particular women here. I think that would be one of the things, again, that would sort of begin to unravel a whole series of other things if there is in fact information wrapped up in the kind of things that the FBI seized during those raids. That was what struck me immediately about this.
Mm-hmm. This news overshadowing more turnover in White House staff. President Trump's advisor on Homeland Security, he was one who helped coordinate the administration's response to the series of powerful hurricanes we had last year, leaving the White House. Tom Bossert, departure as counterterrorism and homeland security advisor comes one day after John Bolton took over as the president's national security advisor. Jim McCormick, pushed out by Bolton?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question about it that Bolton wanted to, he's already reconfigured a little bit the responsibilities within the National Security Council, and he wants to bring that homeland security advisor, which is, a presidential kind of appointment. He wants to bring it under the National Security Council venue here. And, of course, under Trump's arrangement of the National Security Council system, Bolton, as the National Security Advisor, really has broad sway over the basic structure and the implementation. So this is no doubt a movement to for Bolton to get his people in place and to get rid of anybody that might be. Although apparently Bossert had differences with McMaster, but to get his own people in place.
Mm-hmm. Hans, your comment on Bolton's influence in this very short time in the administration.
I mean, I actually wanted to go back to the firing of Mueller, the mm-hmm. question about filing. So there's actually some reports coming out of Politico that have suggested that there's they have this bipartisan Senate bill designed to protect Mueller's job, and it's actually. Grassley hasn't officially announced it, but all indications are that that's actually going to get a vote in the Judiciary Committee, which I think is a significant step to getting legislation through the Senate. I mean, I think that the fact that he's indicated a willingness to bring that to a vote in the full committee, I think, is substantial, because I think that I think I generally agree with Jim's view that it would be unlikely that Trump would fire Mueller, but I think that this is kind of recognizing where the constituencies are and where these senators view of that possibility, that it is a logistical possibility, and there is some at least legitimate concern about that possibility.
It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Let's move on to more developments happening at this time. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg currently in his second day of testimony before Congress, appearing in front of the Senate Judiciary and Commerce Committees. Questions yesterday included the Facebook's role in the 2016 presidential elections, how it handles data. Zuckerberg answered questions on how Facebook will handle future elections, whether it was a monopoly and how it should be regulated. Let's listen to this as a rather interesting exchange. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg testifying before the Senate committee yesterday about data mining on his social networking site. Illinois Democrat Senator Dick Durbin summing up the purpose of yesterday's inquiry in this exchange.
Mr. Zuckerberg, would you be comfortable sharing with us the name of the hotel you stayed in last night?
No.
If you've messaged anybody this week, would you share with us the names of the people you've messaged?
Senator, no, I would probably not choose to do that publicly here.
I think that may be what this is all about.
Okay, Democratic Senator Dick Durbin and Mark Zuckerberg. Tell us, what do you think of the first day and a half of I don't know if you've had your eyes glued on the live feed there, Hans, but what do you take away so far?
Well, I think I'm encouraged and disappointed. I think that it's good to put this in the spotlight. I think that this is, you know, very clear. This is kind of a good example of, you know, fire alarm patrol by Congress. So we have this item is raised, and then Congress investigates, right? You have these news reports of what Cambridge Analytica did. And the Facebook advertisements that were run there. So I think that's very encouraging. I think that I'm a little concerned about the knowledge of the individuals who are grilling. I don't know if you saw Senator Orrin Hatch's exchange where he questioned Zuckerberg, right? How does Facebook make profits, given that the users don't pay anything to use the system? And Zuckerberg's response was, "Well, we run ads."
Right.
So that was not particularly encouraging in terms of, you know, the ability of these groups these individuals to get to the bottom of the system. However, I do think that kind of making this a news item will hopefully encourage further investigation and eventually some sort of regulation or some sort of oversight in terms of, so that we don't have these things happening again.
Right. And what you just said reminds me of that old slogan to keep in mind: if you are not paying for the product, you are the product.
Exactly. And this is something that Orrin Hatch hadn't, and I think this is right. You get a whole bunch of octogenarians trying to use social media, right? You get mixed results, right? We're fortunate that we've got Chuck Grassley, who has a very good grasp on this, right? Just, you know, following his Twitter account. But there are others that have no idea how to log into social media or how to use a computer or, you know, a variety of other things. And so there's quite a wide range here in terms of expertise. And you can be assured that they're probably going to be relying very much on their staff to write these bills and these sorts of things. And hopefully that they're going to kind of get the information that they need to write regulation to kind of prevent these sorts of things from happening.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, your reaction to this Zuckerberg testimony so far?
Well, just to kind of continue the metaphor that Hans used about fire alarms, I don't expect the Congress to engage in many police patrols here, which is sort of the other way to think about the congressional oversight role here. And what was really sort of disappointing to hear is that, you know, apparently there was an admitted violation by Zuckerberg that in 2015, when they found out that information was shared with, I guess, Cambridge Analytica, that even though they had an agreement with the government or the FTC to turn over that information, they didn't do that. And it'll be interesting to see if there's really any action taken against Facebook and their failure to sort of live up to that agreement. I think that's the other sort of downside. And I was thinking about this, you know, I mean, are we going to have a situation here that that Facebook is too big, too complex to regulate here? You know, just like we had with some of the banks previously, too big to fail. Are we going to have a situation that this is too massive and too complex to regulate, despite what Zuckerberg said yesterday, that he's willing to accept, or even today, I guess, too, that he's willing to accept some regulation? The question is, how would you devise that, and how would you, and more importantly, how would you enforce it?
Right, right. And Facebook, one of the cruxes here is that Facebook is under fire for not having a clear explanation of how the data it collects is being used. There was an exchange with the senator from Louisiana, John Kennedy, highlighting this point. The quote I have before me, here's what everyone's been trying to tell you today, Mr. Zuckerberg, and I say it gently, your user agreement sucks. The purpose of a user agreement is to cover Facebook's rear end, not to inform users of their rights. So, Hans, is there a business model that, that protects from what's happened with Facebook up to this point and continues to let Facebook thrive to the extent that it will in a free market?
Well, I mean, I think that you're right, that user agreement is it's never to inform individuals about what they're getting into. It's to cover their rear ends in some way, and I think that but I think that that hasn't deterred people from engaging with that platform previously, and I'm not sure that it will, you know, going forward either. I mean, I think that Facebook thrives in part because it offers an opportunity for people to do things that they want to do and make connections that they want to. And I think that as long as it's a product, it will continue to engage. Now, whether the government or some other role can kind of step in and encourage transparency and ethical behavior in some way, I think that is a good rule for government in some ways.
Okay, Jim, we've got about a minute left. I want to have you tackle quickly an update on the what seems to be a deepening trade war with China, or are we seeing some sort of de-escalation here? China saying wider market access for foreign investors may be possible, right?
Right, and they also, you know, the President Xi Jinping, you know, just apparently made a speech the other day and said that he, you know, wants to cooperate in terms of some of the tariff reductions, particularly on auto imports to China from the United States. So maybe that's an opening, but I think the proof is in the pudding, as always.
Yeah. And a lot of concerned listeners out there, we are an ag state. We are a state that produces not only agricultural products, but also farm machinery, and is being targeted now by the Chinese retaliation. I want to thank you, Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University, Hans Hassel, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College. Jim and Hans, always good to be with you. Thank you so much for joining us this Wednesday.
Thank you very much.